This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the December 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Spirits from the Vasty Deep by John Morrissey. Afanks were terrible things to work with. Huge and wet and hairy they were, always ill-tempered and noisy and rude. They took particular pleasure in materializing in a wizard's chamber the very instant a spell was done, waving a spear and shouting threats and getting water and weeds and muck all over things. That was your typical Afank notion of fun. Kendragern hated summoning them up or working with them. He did not even like to think about them. But everything in this world has its place, and so do things in the worlds beyond. There was nothing like an Afank for dealing with fire demons. Those wretched things could have you ringed with flame as tight as a baby in a blanket. But turn an Afank loose on them, and before a generous pinch of sand had gone through the glass, there was nothing left but steam and a charred spot here and there. Afanks worked every time. All the same, thought the wizard, as he took his spelling book down from the shelf, it's far wiser not to get mixed up with fire demons in the first place. Anyone who does has no one to blame but himself. His present client was a perfect example. Just because one is known as Troem of the Terrible Temper, one can't call a sorceress nasty names and expect to get away with it. This experience probably wouldn't improve Troem's temper either. However, it worked out. Sighing and shaking his head at the human condition, Kendragern laid the speller on his work table, opened the book with care, and set to his work. The spell for summoning an Afank was complex and subtle, as one might expect of any magic dealing with a Celtic water spirit. What with half the words being unpronounceable and the other half sounding just enough like something else to keep him confused and stumbling, it was a full and difficult day's work simply to get everything organized. By mid-afternoon, he had had enough of it and needed a break. He rang for his house troll, ordered a mug of cold ale to be brought out to the comfortable chair under the oaks, and slipped from the house as quietly as possible so as not to disturb his wife. Princess had recently discovered the virtues of the afternoon nap, and as he sat under the trees waiting for his ale, Kendragern reflected that she was probably the only sensible member of the household. Spot burst from the house on great flat feet and skidded to a halt at its master's side with a cry of, "Yah, yah!" Despite its headlong speed, it had not spilled a drop of ale. "Well done, Spot. Quick but careful. That's the way." "Yah? Nothing else, thank you," said the wizard, taking the beaded tankard. "You may as well find yourself a cool place and rest until dinner time." "Yah," said the little troll, bouncing up and down in glee. Its ears flapped audibly. "No sense in all of us drudging away in this heat," said Kendragern, leaning back with a martyred sigh. "I'll carry on alone." Spot left him, and he reclined for a time, eyes closed, idly half listening to the stitch and tick of insects, the distant bird calls, the faint rustle of the upper branches in the mild afternoon breeze. It was very restful and far more pleasant than the stuffy confines of his workroom. He was sorely tempted to surrender to the day and drift off into sleep, letting Troem sweat and sizzle for a few hours more. But a promise was a promise. A commitment was a commitment. More to the point, a client was a client, and a fee was a fee. And Troem's messenger had paid generously in advance. One could ask no greater proof of urgency. Kettergern hitched himself up a bit, took a sip of the cold ale, and faced his obligations. A quarter of an hour's rest, no more, and then back to work. When that fat white cloud touched the edge of the grove, he would rise and return to his labors. He took a deeper draught, observed a bee making its rounds, studied with delight a hummingbird that hovered just beyond his reach, and then checked the progress of the white cloud. It seemed to have grown a bit, but moved no nearer to the grove of aspen. Looking at it more closely, Kettergern saw that it was a very smooth and unusually shiny cloud. Instead of drifting lazily eastward, as all the other clouds were doing, it was coming towards him. This was decidedly uncloud-like behavior. He reached in his tunic and drew out the silver medallion of his guild. Raising it to his eye, he peered through the aperture of true vision and gave a little gasp of surprise. The cloud was not a cloud. It was a bowl-shaped thing of white metal, and it appeared to be making for a landing in the meadow before the house. This had to be the work of an Afank. Who but a Celtic water spirit would travel in something shaped like a big bowl? And only an Afank would have the effrontery to anticipate a spell and arrive ahead of time and in its own vehicle. Kettergern gulped the remaining ale and climbed resolutely to his feet, jaw set firmly, brow furrowed in wrath. This Afank should learn that Kettergern of Silent Thunder Mountain was not a wizard to be trifled with. The flying bowl descended smoothly and silently. It was much larger than it had first appeared, the size of a small castle, at least. The Afank must have brought its tarn along with it, Kedrin thought, his anger growing. That great bowl would leave an awful dent in his meadow. The nerve of the creature was galling. About 20 feet from the ground, the bowl slowed. At 10 feet, it stopped and hovered noiselessly. There was a click and a soft whirr, and 5 absurdly spindly legs slid from the bottom of the thing to plant broad, rounded bases on the ground. White spots around the bowl began to glow brightly, several of them flickering in vivid colors. The air around Kurdgen grew tingly, as if charged with powerful enchantment. This seemed to smack of more than mere Afranks. It might well be that Adagiva, the sorceress who had beset Troem with fire demons, had learned of Kedragern's work and was trying to undermine it, and she might be assisted by others. Like any wizard, Kedragern had made enemies, sometimes without knowing. Whatever the case, there was no point in being foolhardy. He worked a quick but powerful short-term, all-purpose protective spell and stood with arms folded and expression dour, awaiting the appearance of the Afank. The side of the bowl opened, and a long, broad ramp unfolded itself like a black tongue and came to the ground a few paces before him. Kettergern did not move or alter his expression. After a silent moment, 2 figures began to descend the ramp. They did not walk as men would, nor did they flow on watery steeds as would Afanks. Indeed, they did nothing at all. The ramp itself moved, bringing them to the ground a few paces from the wizard. They were very ugly, even for Afanks. They had bowls over their heads filled with a murky soup through which their faces appeared to be a putrid purplish blue-green with patches of yellowy-gray. They had wide, slobbery mouths and far too many eyes and arms and fingers. They were not hairy in the typical Afank way, not visibly, at least, since they were covered head to foot in what looked like cloth of gold, a rather sumptuous outfit, the wizard thought, for a water spirit. They had no feet at all, and no discernible legs, only a kind of columnar trunk rounded off at the bottom. They floated in the air, unmoving, about a forearm's length above the ramp, looking at the wizard, showing off their shoddy magic, he thought, and sniffed. I suppose you think this is very clever, very witty, ever so droll, Kendragern said coldly. Several of the outermost arms of the left-hand Afank twitched slightly. The other Afank started to drift to one side, but brought itself back into place at once. Neither of them spoke or attempted to communicate with the wizard. Well, I'm not amused. Do you hear that, you two? Kendragern is not the least bit amused. He went on. You can tell that to Adajiva, too, and whoever else put you up to this, and you can tell them I won't forget. The Afanks slowly turned to face each other. Inside their helmets, their features moved and light flickered. They appeared to be communicating with one another and ignoring Kendragern. Angered by this new rudeness, he became caustic. Look at yourselves. Ridiculous. Do you hear me? You look ridiculous. Cloth of gold, like a pair of mincing court fops, and those silly glass bowls over your heads don't help either. What's the matter? Ashamed of being all wet and hairy and drippy? Well, I can't blame you for that, but you might have dressed yourselves up in something more becoming, like a greasy old wash rag. And where are your horses and your spears? What kind of a thanks? You speak our language, a flat, tinny voice said. Don't interrupt me when I'm ranting, Kendragern cried. Of course I speak your language. How else can I tell you what I think of this ludicrous performance of yours, flying about in an oversized washtub, dressed up like a pair of clowns with arms and fingers all over the place and no feet? How do you speak our language? You wear no translating machine, the voice broke in. I don't need a translating machine, whatever that is. I don't need any machine to speak your language or anyone else's, said Kendragern. Machines are nothing but big, clumsy things that creak and rattle and break down when you need them most and end up a heap of firewood. Machines are as stupid and unreliable as effects. Which brings me back. Where is your translator? What is your source of power? The tinny voice broke in once more. It seemed to come from a box on the side of the glass bowl worn by one of the Afanks. Kendragern bit his lip and took a deep breath to calm himself. This was pushiness to an intolerable degree. To anticipate the summons of a wizard, to land this great white basin on his meadow in the precise spot where it would obstruct his favored view, and then to interrupt him repeatedly with stupid questions about machines and strictly personal matters like his source of power could be tolerated no longer. Kendragern took a step back and extended his hand towards the Afank that had spoken. One good scorching blast of magic would do more to teach the thing manners than all the shouting Kendragern could do in an afternoon. As he lowered his hand, the Afanks quickly reacted. Each of them drew from its side a silvery rod and pointed it at the wizard. Kendragern spoke the word of power, and there was a tremendous crackle and zap, a sheet of light that broke into writhing ribbons and a pungent smell in the air. Rubbing at the spots that danced before his eyes, Kendragern saw the Afanks standing on the ramp as before. Nothing seemed to have happened to them. The silver rods were glowing brightly, dripping molten metal on the ground where it struck with a spit and a hiss. The uneasy thought came to him that these effects had some powerful magic behind them. The tinny voice, sounding a bit livelier, interrupted his rumination. "This being has a powerful technology at his command. Never before has an organic life form withstood the plasma beam," it said. An identical tinny voice from its companion added, "Its shielding device would appear to be superior to our own. Notice the effect it had on the projectors. They are destroyed." The two of them turned to face him, though he was still a bit bedazzled by the brilliance of the flash. Kedrigan knew he must remain on the offensive. He hardened his expression and said, "Some damage has been done to my meadow. You will repair it before I release you." "Release? Release?" both voices said at once, in a tone of querulous metallic alarm. "We are not prisoners. You are prisoner. As you very well know, I brought you here to do a task for me. You're a bit ahead of time, but it's still a result of my summons, and you'd be wise not to forget that," said Kedrigan with forced calm. "When the task is completed to my satisfaction, I will release you from the spell and send you back where you came from. If you fail me or try any more of these tricks, I will work another spell and send you someplace very nasty and keep you there for a long, long time. Do you understand?" "Do you claim that you brought us here?" one Afank said. "Of course. Now, since we will be working together, let us have no more talk of prisoners. I'm willing to overlook your little prank as long as you get right to work and do the job properly. Here's the problem. Troem of the Terrible Temper had the poor judgment to make an insulting remark about Adajiva, a sorceress, and she... Guidance system does not permit override by extravehicular agencies," one Afank broke in. "I'm sure it doesn't," said Kedrigan condescendingly. "As I was saying, Adajiva learned of the remark, and understandably she felt that she, your detectable power sources, are insufficient to enable you to interfere significantly with our functions," the other Afank interrupted. Kedrigan's expression became grim. "All right," he said softly. "That's it. I tried to be nice. I was ready to forgive and forget, but there will be no more carrot and stick for you two. Only stick, and I mean to lay it on hard. The situation justifies use of the main plasma beam battery," said one Afank, and the other said, "Agree, prepare main battery." The huge white bowl spun, though its legs remained in place. A hole opened in its side. A group of large silvery rods emerged and turned to point at the wizard. He took the precaution of invoking a backup for his protective spell, and as the silvery rods locked on him, he closed his eyes tightly and clapped a hand over them as an extra precaution against the brilliant light that these creatures used in such an annoying way. The crackle and zap were much louder this time. The air tingled more palpably, and the smell was sharper. It was powerful magic, but it was unimaginative, merely repeating oneself on a larger scale, like shouting a repetition of such spell that had made no impression when simply spoken. It was typical of Afank's. No finesse. Kedrigan peeked between his fingers. The silvery rods looked like melted candles, and a charred patch encircled the hole from which they sagged. He felt very pleased with himself. It was always so satisfying to make the other fellow's magic work against him. Lowering his hand, he looked around and gave a cry of dismay at the sight of his meadow. It was black and smoking for 100 paces in every direction. "Now you're going to get it," he said with a swift gesture. This time, There were no rods to contend with, hence no noise and glare and stink. In an instant, the effects were each encased in a column of ice. That would hold them while the wizard decided on a suitable way to deal with them. The voices sounded slightly muffled. There was a thin squeal to them as one said, "This is impossible," and the other, "Agree, this situation is incompatible with the laws of physics and cannot be occurring." "If you think this is impossible, just wait," Kentigern said ominously as he surveyed the blasted meadow. "Yah! Yah!" cried a distant voice. Spot burst from the house and bounded across the intervening space to its master's side, where it stopped, panting and salivating, eager to protect its master against the intruders. "Thank you, Spot, but everything is under control now," the wizard reassured it, stooping to pat its warty head. "I'm just weighing my options for dealing with this pair." "Yeah?" the little troll asked softly. "If you like, just don't touch the effects. You might stick." Kentigern looked at the intruders, then at his blackened meadow, then at the effects again. Should he simmer them slowly in a volcano? Freeze them solid and embed them in a glacier? Send them to the driest, sandiest waste in Araby? He weighed one form of chastisement against another, looked again at the meadow, and began to relent. A burn-off did the meadow no harm. In fact, it was beneficial. Everything would grow back next spring, probably greener than ever. All would be well, except for the effects. He looked thoughtfully upon the twin columns of ice. These wretched creatures could not help being what they were and acting as they did. A thanks will be a thanks. They were dupes of some malicious intelligence, mere pawns, more sinned against than sinning. Severe and enduring punishment would be too cruel. All the same, they needed a good lesson. They had been insufferably cheeky to a wizard, and such behavior could not be countenanced, or in a very short time, every ogre, troll, fiend, goblin, and wicked fairy in the neighborhood would look upon him as Kentigern the Soft and make his life miserable with their pranks. Consigned punishment was the thing, neither too lenient nor too severe, but just suited to the offense. As Kentigern stood in thought, scratching his chin and running through his inventory of punitive spells, Spot investigated the scene. It looked closely at the twin columns of ice, sniffing but not touching, in obedience to its master's command. Finding nothing of interest, Spot poked about in the blackened meadow, then turned its attention to the slender legs supporting the flying bowl. Sniffing revealed nothing, so Spot touched the thing gingerly. The base of the leg was a round pad, about as thick as a man's forearm and perhaps three times as broad in diameter, hard on top but flexible on the bottom, so as to adapt to the contours of the surface on which it rested. Spot pushed a hand underneath the pad and felt it yield. He poked one adamantine finger into the top and dented the metal slightly. Murmuring a thoughtful, "Yeah," the little troll stared at the leg for a moment and then decisively took a solid grip and tore the pad loose. The grating of metal set Kedrigern's teeth on edge. The entire bowl gave a shudder, and anxious cries issued from the ice columns. Spot carried the pad and its accompanying length of leg to the wizard, dropping it at his feet with an earth-shattering thud. "Yah!" said the troll with quiet pride. "Thank you, Spot." "No more! Spare our vessel!" the effects cried as one. "Are you requesting or commanding?" Kentigern asked. After a brief pause, one of the voices said, "We are imploring!" Oh, good. That's an improvement. Spot, you stay here by me. Don't tear off anything else until I give the word. Yeah. Release us, and we will spare your planet. We will leave and never return, said a voice from the ice. Not so fast. There's a matter of a few fire demons to be wet down. What is fire demons? Don't play dumb. Every Afank knows what a fire demon is. What is Afank? Afank is you. Wizard is me. And don't forget it. You have misapprehended. We are not Afank. Really? Tell me, what are you then? We are Jasporo Oxo Mixlotil. We are all-knowing and all-powerful. We are masters of Jasporo Oxomix Prime and its adjacent worlds, explorers of the cosmos, voyagers among the stars, conquerors of the universe. You don't seem to be doing too well. After an embarrassed pause, one of the voices said, Even conquerors of the universe do not win them all. That was a profound observation, but not of much relevance to the matter at hand. The entire exchange only confirmed what Kedrigern had known all along. Afanks are impossible to deal with. Either they bluster and bully, or they tell whoppers. Still, this particular whopper had a kind of outrageous appeal. It was not your ordinary fib, or typical traveler's tall story. Kedrigern found it amusing and decided to see how far the Afanks could carry it. Tell me more about this place you come from, he said. It is difficult to speak at length when completely encased in ice, one voice replied. Huh, I suppose it is. All right, I'll release your top half, but no tricks or you'll end up in the center of an iceberg. The upper portion of each ice column vanished instantaneously. The intruders exchanged a glance, and one said, We misjudged in classifying these beings as primitive. Their technology is most advanced. Kedrigern was not certain what they meant, but their tone was respectful, and he had no wish to disillusion them. He acknowledged the statement with a careless shrug, and said, We muddle along well enough, a spell here, a spell there, and the work gets done. I believe you were going to tell me about Jaspox, about your home. Jasporo Oxomix is the center of the universe and seat of all knowledge. It is the fourth of seven planets in a binary system, five of which have been fully colonized. Of the remaining planets, one is a penal colony, the other a refuse dump. Ours is a crowded system, but since the perfection of the Hooksel star drive, we have been able... The tinny voice began. Kedrigern let the creature rattle on. It was all gibberish, but the performance was amusing. He did his best to maintain a serious expression, now and then nodding or raising his eyebrows to indicate agreement or wonder, and interjecting an occasional, ah, or I see, to attest to his engrossment in the monologue. He was willing to go along with the joke, but at last, as Afanks were wont to do, the creature exceeded all license. Ours is a binary system, it said, composed of a blue giant and a red dwarf rotating around one another in perfect stability. It is believed... Now you go too far, said Kedrigern. I happen to know a number of giants personally, and dozens of dwarfs, and if there's one thing they are not, it's compatible. Giants are loners, and dwarfs are worse. They can't even stand to have other dwarfs around them, let alone a giant, particularly... A blue giant. After a pause, the Afank said, Nevertheless, our sons are a blue giant and a red dwarf. Kedrigern gave a whoop of laughter. Oh, They're your sons, are they? Congratulations! Tell me, which of you is the father of the blue giant, and which of the red dwarf? Or are you father and mother? You do not believe in our description of the Jasperoaxomix system? Said one, a Fank. I do not. You were very plausible and amusing until you started going on about things you clearly don't understand. I have visited several giants and come to know them fairly well. It's difficult to get close to a dwarf, but I've learned what I could about them. The two are utterly incompatible, the wizard said dogmatically. The Afanks turned towards one another, flashing lights inside their bowls, covering their heads, suggested a lively exchange, which Kedrigern could not hear. When the lights faded, one Afank said, Your words suggest unanticipated danger to the Jasperoaxomix system. Please explain. This has gone far enough, I think. We're chatting away here while Troem burns, and we really ought to get down to business. What I want you to do is, please explain. Important. You must explain danger of instability, the voice broke in. Now just stop it, said the wizard angrily. I've been very patient, but when you... Explanation is essential. Explain fully the danger to Jasperoaxomix system, said one voice, and the other chimed in. Explain, explain immediately. Tell us all you know. The system must be preserved. In a rising pitch that pained the wizard's ears, he commanded them to stop, threatening more and thicker ice, but the unremitting metallic voices went on without pause, growing louder and more piercing. The two figures, still locked in ice from the midpoint down, waved their multiple arms and fingers in a distracting manner and began to vibrate. Holes opened in the sides of the flying bowl, and from them issued a deeper voice demanding, Tell us all you know of the danger to our system. Reveal all. Tell all. Explain all. Furious, Kedrigern raised his hands and cried, Go back where you came from this instant, and uttered words of great power. Bowl and Afanx vanished. Nothing remained but a burnt patch in the meadow, 5 circular impressions in the grass, 2 puddles, and the footpad torn loose by Spot. Yeah? The little troll asked. I lost my temper, Kedrigern muttered. Yeah, I know, I should have had them take care of the fire demons before I let them go, but they got me angry. That's the last time I have anything to do with a Fanks. Yeah? I'll get in touch with a Nixie. That will do the job. Or maybe a sea nymph. Troem would probably prefer a sea nymph. They're pretty little things, but Troem isn't much concerned about looks at this point. Just wetness. I suppose the safest thing would be a long, drenching rain. He pondered that for a moment, then brightened. Yes, rain. I can get us a bit while I'm at it and clean up the meadow. Rain it is, nice and quick and clean. I'll have Troem soaked to the skin within the hour, he said, rubbing his hands together briskly. Why didn't I think of this in the first place? Simple methods are usually the best. Fooling around with a Fanks, nasty, pushy things, no manners at all, brutes, liars, all that rubbish about 7 planets going around a blue giant and a red dwarf. Nonsense. Utter nonsense. He shook his head irritably and looked down on the broken footpad. He gazed upon it for a time, frowning. Then he looked up into the immensity of the sky. Yeah? Spot asked. He nudged the footpad with the toe of his boot. Get rid of this thing. I don't want to see it again. As Spot trudged off to bury the pad, Kedrigern looked up again into the limitless blue and said very softly, A Fanks, Then he turned, and with lowered head and pensive expression, he made his way over the singed meadow towards the house and his workroom. We continue with a story from the November 1986 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is The Year All the Kennedy Children Ran for President by Gerald Jonas. But tell me, Signor Galileo, how is it that your spyglass enables me to see stars that are not there? My head hurts. I'm afraid to move it. I haven't moved my head for so long. My neck is stiff. Maybe that's why my head hurts. Sometimes I tell myself that I can just move my head. The pain will go away. But then I tell myself that unless I keep my head absolutely motionless, it will fall off. Given such contradictory advice, I decide to do nothing, and I keep my head absolutely motionless. Confession time. The reason I stopped moving my head was that I started thinking about the meaning of life, and suddenly I understood what it was all about. I found this was paralyzing. I was afraid I'd lose the insight if I did anything rash. I call my insight the theory of the many eyes inside the head. According to this theory, all our troubles stem from the fact that we insist on thinking of ourselves as individuals when our experience indicates otherwise. Far from being a unitary point of consciousness with a coherent Weltanschauung and a single monthly statement, each of us behaves like a whole crowd of people, confident one moment, depressed the next, in love, then angry, then filled with a sense of unearned contentment. People say, he's moody. Wrong. It's the other way around. His moods are him. You're probably saying to yourself, I don't believe a word of this. That's precisely what I said to myself at first. But did I listen? A dentist once told me my gums were in lousy shape. And if the gums go, he said, making a little joke, can the teeth be far behind? What should I do? I asked. Brush up and down, not sideways, he said. Brush more, brush harder, brush till it hurts. I tried that, I said, but it hurts. Not really, he said. It doesn't really hurt. You only think it does. Your gums are so flabby, so lazy, that they sense any stimulation at all as pain. So brush till it hurts, and it won't. At first I thought he was crazy, but I tried it, and he was right. All the really great thinkers down through the ages, I mean philosophy's all-time superstars, when confronting the mystery of the soul, or self, have divided it up into parts. Take Plato, for example. Most people would put him in the top five, maybe even the top three, when it comes to day-in, day-out thinking. According to Plato, who wrote a little story or parable about it, man has a tripartite soul, will, appetite, and I forget the third. The details aren't important, as I'll explain in a moment. Aristotle, another biggie, wrote about a vegetable soul, an animal soul, and a mineral soul. Actually, that's a little joke. The last of the dynamic trio was a rational soul, although I suspect that Aristotle would have embraced the notion of a mineral soul if he had thought of it first. But if someone else had suggested it to him, like, say, Philodendron of Thrace, he would have said, no way, and brilliantly demolished the very idea of a mineral soul with the kinds of arguments that make you want to cry because you suspect they're wrong, but damned if you can think of a way to convince anyone else. Maybe later that night, just before getting into bed, you come up with a brilliant counterexample, but by that time it's too late. All the philosophers are fast asleep, and only night breezes disturb the deserted porches of the academy. And even if you remember your counterexample in the morning, the other thinkers have embarked on a long weekend to the islands, and besides, you're not so sure now that there isn't an even more brilliant counterexample, so you, as they say, keep your thoughts to yourself. But what, you ask, are the practical applications of any of the theory of the many eyes inside the head? Well, have you ever shampooed your head with a brand called Apple Essence that you picked up for 20 cents off at the local discount store? Rinsed off the first lather, which smells a little like hard cider, reached half-blinded by soapy water for the apple-shaped bottle to give yourself a second lathering, the thick, satisfying, whipped cream-like goop you get only the second time around, and by accident, your hand closes on another bottle, this one shaped like a tree stump and called Man Teak with Dandruff Fighting XT7, which your kids bought at the local supermarket to get the coupon to enter the Vacation for Two in Papillus sweepstakes. And rather than grope again, you go ahead and use it, feeling only a little bit silly about having not one, but two weird scents in your hair. Well, according to the theory of the many eyes inside your head, your accidental grab the second time around was no accident. The first shampoo was the choice of the eye that likes Apple Essence, or at least its price. But sometime between the first and second lather, another eye took control of your head, and this second eye wanted to try Man Teak with Dandruff Fighting XT7. While such information may not change your life, it should come in handy the next time you go shopping. As the perspicacious reader has no doubt already noticed, not all of these paragraphs were written by the same eye. The previous paragraph, for example, is clearly the product of a dyspeptic wiseacre who hopes to divert the general public from the point of this story by making light of it. With this transparent maneuver, of course, the perpetrator has unwittingly demonstrated the validity of the very theory he wishes to discredit. Freud understood a thing or two or three. Id, ego, superego. He knew there was always someone inside your head looking over your shoulder. Mental contortions. Where id was, there ego shall be, not to mention superego, nagging, nagging, nagging. Why did Freud divide the self, or soul, into exactly three parts instead of four or five or six? Exhaustive research suggests three possible answers. One, Freud had enough trouble naming id, ego, and superego. What would he have called the other parts? Hans? Carl? Anna? Two. Three was good enough for the likes of Plato and Aristotle, so Freud felt comfortable with it. Three. Three was his lucky number. The problem, of course, is consciousness. If there are many eyes in the head, which one gets to sit in the driver's seat? Take out the garbage? Sign the checks? Is there a rotation system? Ego on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays, superego on Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays, and id on Saturday night when it's time to boogie? Don't bet on it. Consciousness is the brass ring, and you don't give it up until you have to. It's war in there, man. Confession time. What started my head hurting was an article I read in a magazine about a case of multiple personality. This kook was so confused, he didn't believe he was a single coherent personality with occasional lapses of memory and sudden shifts of mood and an occasional inability to choose between two divergent courses of action and chronic ambivalent feelings towards his family and friends and job, like the rest of us sane people. No, this kook insisted that his head contained about 8 or 10 personalities, not even a sane 3, mind you, with real names like Fred and the kid. And sometimes this kook would be Fred, a responsible, hard-working family man. And then pow, just like that, he'd become the kid, a wild, reckless guy who drove too fast and pinched waitresses and ate too many sweets. And what he said, this kook, is that the spot would suddenly switch from Fred to the kid. And by the spot, what he meant was the spotlight of consciousness, how it happened, what caused the spot to switch so suddenly from one personality to another. He didn't know, this kook. When I was young, I often wished my parents had named me Tim. There were times when I was Tim. Sometimes when I wasn't Tim, I felt bad about it, wondering where he was, how he was doing. I would have written him a letter, but I didn't know how to address it. A name is a kind of story. I once knew a writer who said, "The only kind of story I like to write is the kind of story I hate to read." So he used a pseudonym. If you want to, you can think of the many eyes inside the head as subprograms of the metacomputer known as the soul or the self. If you don't want to, don't. According to a recent survey, 8 out of 10 people admitted that they didn't understand the words subprogram, metacomputer, and soul. Everyone understood self, head, and I. A head is real because you can hold it in your hands. The brain is real because you can hold it in your head. Something inside the brain makes up stories about the fireworks that fizz and boom from one end of the nervous system to the other. A name is a story. A mood is a story. An obsession is a story. Einstein's general theory of relativity is a story. Darwin told a great story. Evolutionarily speaking, some stories work out better than others. The question is, better for whom? Fred? The kid? Tim? The problem, or course, is death. According to a recent survey, there are at least 3 kinds of death to worry about. 1, the death of an I, as in, I don't love you anymore. This is sometimes called giving up or growing up. 2, the death of consciousness, as when the spot suddenly deserts one's personality and there is no replacement ready. This is sometimes called ecstasy or insanity. 3, death with a capital D. If life is a story, this is the end. The point of this story is to get all this stuff out of my head so that I can move it again. At first, I thought I was going to call this story stories to emphasize the point. But then I thought, what if someone says this isn't really a story? This kook really believes all this stuff about the theory of the many eyes inside the head. So I made up a title that has nothing to do with the point, except, of course, on a deep symbolic level. I also made up the epigraph. I feel better already. How do you feel? We conclude with poems from the summer 2024 issue of the magazine of Fantian Science Fiction. The first, In a Castle, Far from Every Prince, by Mariska Pichette. white dress, frosted with lace weeping threads, hem worn from wandering white marble halls, cold as snow, sunsets blood red, rose red, and nights raven black. I tried growing my hair long as towers, long as history, long as these empty, empty halls. Oils and braiding and fancy shampoos never worked, left my hair brittle, and only just past my shoulders years and years on. I stopped trying to fit that fairy tale. I thought I'd grow apples and roses, coat fields and flowers and fruit that I'd bake into pies and press into cider to warm me each winter next. But I grew tired of farming, my hands chapped and back aching, and when the first gray snuck into my dark brown, never black, never luscious hair, I put my seeds away. One winter, I thought I'd sleep, the seasons away, pad my face with mud masks and stop each wrinkle before it formed. I was too late, of course. The wrinkles began in my 20s and continued spreading like frost. I don't sleep well at the best of times, rising to wander in moonlight and snack in the kitchen when the mice are asleep. So no, I decided that story wasn't for me. I never learned to swim, so the pond stays isolated. It's merfolk and frogs, unkissed, undanced, under the willows, only wind. I thought finally about reading. How else can I travel without cramming my feet into too tight shoes meant only for parties? I filled my pockets with snacks and retired to the library only to find that most of the books are quite boring, not for me, and the cord for the Kindle is terribly short, and the chairs not as comfortable as they looked from afar. So no, I am not fair, or smart, or lovesick, or distressed, or waiting for someone to tell me who I'll be. I know, I dread gardening, I loathe cleaning, I hate socializing. I know I can't swim, can't cook, can't sleep well at all. I know there are some books I love, but most I don't. Some nights I am light, but most I am heavy. I know all these things about myself, and in finding out each, I lived. I tried it all, and I've decided I like myself best. I like wandering at night and letting my tea grow cold. I like dozing on the couch and dyeing my hair. I like myself a lot, and I don't mind if I change and I grow old, because I know that each year I try something I likely won't like at all, I'm knowing myself more, and I'm loving that self better than all the ones I knew before. We end with City as Fairy Tale by Richard Lays. The last human and her descendants are vines. They cling to swollen nursing trees, crawl a twisted wilderness in bloodthirsty symbiosis from iron root to verdigris leaf. Curious shoots climb high for a glimpse of city. Grandmother tells how endless labyrinths of machine and concrete poisoned the ground, water, air, scorched the planet, left behind robots that reenact the end of days in loops under empty skyscrapers. How the stray vine that reaches too far will encounter toxins in the city, having succumbed, must be amputated, discarded to rot, before the contagious can spread back to the forest of last resort. How she engorged trees with oxygenated blood, mapped her mammalian and mind to plant genomes, restricted bipedal and running, to clinging and climbing, to outrace the rate of environmental decline, post-human destiny in overgrowth. She wanted it this way, but from blood and chlorophyll to yellow decay in her deepest parts, she wonders what she will leave behind this time. Is there blood enough, room enough for all these younger offshoots crowded on top, blocking the sun from view? This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.